Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net's been going strong for over 44 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios, and we chat with each other, we learn from each other, we teach each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this particular Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email, that would be either for mailbag questions, offer up some TechNet puzzles, they're as rare as hen's teeth, or if you have a technical expertise in the news and you'd like to share it with the group here, you can contact me and we'll set aside some time for that. Or if you want me to ask Paul some space or NASA-related question or something that you've seen on a web page or YouTube, you can send it to me and I'll send it to him, or you can go direct. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com, and mine is mailbag@ac2gs.com. We also offer a link page of interesting articles as I peruse them through the week. If I see something that strikes me as interesting, I will cut and paste them into my link page, and you can get to it by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. We keep that link page alive for a long, long time, so if you have a touch of insomnia and you want to read something that I found interesting, take a look at it. Also, we have available a chat room, if you're so inclined. Sometimes it's very busy. Lately, it's been kind of quiet. It usually quiets down during the summer. And you can reach it by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. That'll bring you to the chat room. We offer an Internet audio stream of the Technical Net. I keep it live the rest of the week because a few people asked me if I could. And so it's a way of listening into the Glen Oaks repeater. You can reach that by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It's been visited by more than a million visitors, and it holds the repository of the archives of the Limark Technical Net to go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've either moved away from the area or unfortunately become a silent key over the years. There's a lot of good information in that website. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what we have got planned. Okay, standard vanilla session today, no guest speakers, what have you. Not much going on with artificial intelligence, but I will mention a topic that we, a subject that we talked about last week that we didn't have that much information on. And after that, we will go to the regular questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask people, hit the push to talk, give me your first name, your call sign, and if it's amateur radio related or science and technology related. That should take us approximately to 10:15, and Paul, WS2N, will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So if the laws of physics continue to work, if the repeater works, if my shack works, and if I don't get kicked off of the airlink too many times, that's the way it should be. So let me drop, and I'll return and tell you what I learned over the past week about a story we talked about last week. Okay, the story was the unfortunate fellow who died. It was mentioned because it's local. People listening tonight know that MRI test diagnostic building very well. Apparently, this guy sort of unfortunately seemed to be asking for problems. He wasn't just wearing, the idea was that he had a metallic bracelet, necklace on, that got attracted to a active MRI machine. You're not supposed to wear any ferrous material anywhere near that damn thing. It has over a tesla of energy, magnetic field flux. So, you know, you're asking to get killed, unfortunately. This guy, unfortunately, was wearing a 20-pound chain, a regular iron link chain with a lock at the bottom. Apparently, he was into some weight training. He was in his mid-60s, but he was doing some weight training that required him to carry around a 20-pound iron link to an MRI facility. And apparently, they knew him. And they had discussed the fact that that's a heck of a big necklace there. And I'm sure they cautioned him. I mean, you know, but this was not the first time his wife apparently was being examined under an MRI. And apparently she had a bad psychological reaction and she cried out in horror and called him forth. And he didn't take off his necklace. He walked right into the room. And the rest, unfortunately, was in the newspapers. So, I don't know what to say. I mean, don't wear anything magnetic anywhere near an MRI machine. And probably they should have told him to take the thing off before he even went into the waiting room. But that's called 20/20 hindsight. So if anyone has any comments about this particular story in the news that we talked about last week before we go on to the main segment, feel free. Hit that push to talk.
KD2AMZ.
Yes, Mike.
Well, I work in a hospital. I work at the VA in Northport. Yes, tragedy, horrible tragedy. But I'm going to be very blunt. Where the hell were the operators? The minute this guy walked in there, they didn't hit the big red button. Where were the operators? They're the ones that should be paying. Quite frankly, should go to jail for not doing their job. That's it. KD2AMZ.
Hey, KE2GIV, I got another VA employee here. I'm at the VA in Manhattan, and I can second that. Normally, there's some x-ray detectors if you walk into the area where the MRI is.
Well, I don't exactly know where he was in relation to the actual MRI. I assume he was in the waiting area that was a little bit farther away, and I thought those things were locked. I thought there was some security. And also, again, the way the story was presented, this is not the first time he came with his wife with his chain around his neck. So, you know, I probably would have very politely thrown his ass out the previous times. I don't think I'd let him get anywhere near the MRI department with an iron chain. I mean, you might as well have a big sign on your back saying, please kill me. So, I don't know. I don't know if it's 100% of the employees. I think they have part of the blame. I think he has part to blame because I'm sure he wasn't completely unaware of the big signs that say no magnetic materials past this point and such. It's almost anyone who's passed by an MRI machine kind of knows that that's a no-no. So I'm still not completely sure what went on, but I think the blame can be shared by many people. Unfortunately, he got the death penalty, so you know, I feel bad for him and his wife and his family, but, you know, I mean, it seems almost like the old joke about Darwin Awards, where you're just making bad decisions in your life that you can't get away with beyond a certain point. We have a very safe society. You can make all kinds of very foolish decisions and still survive them, but there are some decisions that you simply can't survive, and this is one of them.
Again, KD2AMZ. I concur. There, you got to go through a magnetometer. Alarms go off. Everything goes off. I 110% blame the operators. There's no excuse. KD2AMZ.
Okay. I'm sure the family will sue the diagnostic facility and. It may not end up in the front page or the first or the second or the third, but we'll be able to Google it in probably a couple of years because these things, legal battles kind of grind exceedingly slow. So I wouldn't at all be surprised for whatever money is paid out to the family. You won't hear about it for another 4 or 5 years.
Hey, KETGIV here. We just all hope that somebody can avoid a mistake like this happening again, hearing about this one and learning about this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible price to pay, but if someone who would have ordinarily done the same foolish thing hears about this and it registers and it saves that guy's life, at least there's a little bit of positive thinking going on. So I hope so. I mean, this is something that should just be pounded into every single person. Diagnostic equipment can be quite dangerous. There's radioactivity in some of them, there's high voltage potentials in some of them, and there are high magnetic fields in others. So diagnostic tests are not harmless things. In the old days, people kind of didn't understand that anything was a hazard. Those fluorescein fluoroscopes that x-rayed your feet so that you could see how nice your feet fit into your new shoes, you're exposing yourselves to X radiation for the sake of just kind of wiggling your toes was not a bright idea. So, you know, humanity has done a lot of foolish things. On the flip side, people thought that electricity was much more hazardous than it is when factories first became electronic, run by electricity. People wanted hazard pay and all kinds of things because they thought that they were putting their lives at risk. So sometimes we overcompensate for safety issues, and a lot of times we undercompensate. You know, radiation was, when it was first discovered, people were pouring water through a radioactive material and drinking the water. People were dousing themselves because they weren't quite sure what radioactivity was, and they thought it would give you a longer, healthier life when, in fact, it does the exact opposite. So we learn from our mistakes, hopefully. Any other comments before we move on?
Oh, yeah, WA2VDH with a question regarding MRIs and colonoscopy.
Yes, John. Jim recognized. We'll get to you next. But John first.
Yeah, a few years ago I had a colonoscopy followed by an MRI. Now, when I had the MRI, they said some unusual things had shown up in my abdomen. And I had since found out that in the colonoscopy they had used some kind of staples I think where they had a polyp or something. But my question is, are those staples have any ferrous components? Because if it had showed up on the MRI, my question is, could those staples have been yanked right through my gut by the magnetic field? Are there any ferrous components in those staples? Go ahead.
To my understanding, no. I mean, we live in a culture drenched with magnetic resonance imaging machines. And so every manufacturer of anything sort of knows that the last thing you want to put is some ferrous material into a human body because, as you said, it'll rip it right through. It'll wreak havoc. So, no. At least for the last 20 years, to my knowledge, medical science has stayed far away from ferrous materials. There's a whole slew of non-magnetic materials that are available that medical technology avails themselves of.
What caused it to show up on the MRI, or does the MRI show also I guess it would show non-ferrous materials, dissolvable materials, I guess. Is that right?
It sort of depends on the design. Magnetic resonance imaging is a technology that detects RF energy flipping nuclear rotation in a magnetic field. So depending upon the amount of Gauss or Teslas, depending upon the RF, different types of atoms and molecules flip their nuclei and give you an output on the computer display. For the most part, MRIs are sort of tuned for water and close to water resonances. So I would think it was kind of either unusual or it was an opacity that kind of was definitely non-hydrated that showed up kind of as a negative image as opposed to showing up as a positive one.
Very likely a titanium staple, and what you're being reported as is called streak artifact.
Comment?
Yeah, comment.
Alpha Echo 2 Yankee Golf, Sam, two comments. First of all, I just had an MRI of my shoulder, but my shoulder has a complete shoulder replacement in it. And, you know, I was surprised that they were able to do an MRI with a complete total shoulder replacement. That's one comment. The other comment was that you were talking about antiquated knowledge. When I was a kid, I got a rock collection. I got 100 rock samples in a box, all labeled. And included in that box was a sample of asbestos rock. So, it's all very interesting what we learn later on in life. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Sam. I mean, forget about asbestos rocks. When I was in college in chemistry lab, they would regularly give us out asbestos pads and suggest that for some apparatus, we had to take a file and punch a hole in the middle and file it out in without a hood. In the middle of the room, so that we could put a test tube through the hole, and it was fireproof. So I mean, that's more dangerous than just having a damn rock. A lot of medical things are titanium alloys, and so they're designed among other things to be anti-allergenic and that your body will not react to it. There are some metals that your body will really be upset about. If you put something nickel into you, even if you have nickel in the ring, a lot of times you'll have a severe allergic reaction. So titanium is part of the usual alloys that are used. And if you have something like, you know, from 50 years ago, some metal dental work, that's iron, you have to have that removed and replaced before you can walk into the MRI machine. Otherwise, it'll be hell. Okay, I seem to have struck a note, but Jim called out his call sign a while ago. So, Jim, you're next.
Hi, Jim, KD2VHD. I just want to point out that we may presume too much to assume that this is an accident. An airplane just went down recently and everybody assumed it was an accident. Turns out, maybe not. Darwin did some magnificent work. Many of his conclusions are correct. I don't think all of them are correct, but many of them are. And he acknowledged that some of them might not be. But natural selection is a thing. And weird things happen. I think we're assuming way too much about this incident, about people's mindsets, that we have people where they were. The science of it is very interesting. The psychology of it, I don't know. Back to that, thanks.
AC2PL.
Yeah. What can I do you for?
If the previous station is going to talk about science, you might better get more acquainted with what Darwin actually said and what evolution actually means. It has nothing to do with one single act in a single room at a single point in time.
Yeah, but I mean, people have turned it into a black joke with the Darwin Awards. They issued, I think, about 10 different paperback books that were just filled with stories of guys who had a really bad idea and really tried to do it and died because of it. Biological evolutionary experts don't follow Darwin anymore. Darwin was a very good starting point for a couple of hundred years ago before there was any idea of DNA and very little idea of fossils. But evolution has come very far since those days. You know, he is respected as the guy who lit the match, but there's a heck of a lot of evolution out there that has very little to do with Darwin.
Yeah, Roger, and it doesn't happen on a daily basis. It happens in doubling time, so we can watch it happen in E. coli on a petri dish because the doubling time is massive. The doubling time of a human is not sufficient, so one stupid act of... It can't be, you can call it any sort of social thing you want, but let's not call it science, anything other than social science.
Yeah, that's good, social science. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, people have all kinds of interesting, weird ideas about evolution. They think that there's an ultimate goal to things, that we're the ultimate end point of evolution, and or we're going to progress to ever smarter and smarter creatures. There was a very good Twilight Zone episode where the guy who used to be in Man from U.N.C.L.E. was put into an accelerating evolutionary device, and he came out with a big bald head and a sixth finger on each head. And the problem is that evolution is only, it's a reaction to your environment. If your survival is benefited by being smarter, you'll be smarter. If your environment makes it so that your life expectancy is better if you're dumb as a rock, you'll be as dumb as a rock eventually. And so we may evolve to back to not so bright creatures over the millennia if we don't kill each other and ourselves.
Comment?
Yeah, Jim first and you second.
My thoughts were less related to Darwin, although they were involved, than the fact that smart people would realize it may have been a mistake and it may not have been a mistake. That's all. I have to cut out. I'll be back later in that. But enjoy. KD2VHD, back to that.
Okay, I think it was Sam with the comment.
Roger. My two comments. Number one is I just rewatched the movie The Terminator. Terminator with Schwarzenegger. And the role of artificial intelligence in that movie, which is maybe, I don't know, 20 years old or maybe longer, is remarkable because it's about the artificial intelligence taking over the world and exterminating mankind. So that's a very interesting concept of evolution, if you know what I'm saying. The other comment was the Ray Bradbury story. I can't remember the name of the short story, but people were able to go back in time and were told not to do certain things, and someone stepped on a butterfly, and when they came back to the present, the world was slightly different. So those are just two comments about evolution.
Okay, Sam. I would hazard to guess that was the butterfly effect. But I was a big fan of Terminator. Terminator 2 was fantastic. I didn't like any of the other ones, 3, 4, 5, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that there are some guys like Peter Thiel who kind of... They're rooting for the other side for some strange reason. I'm not quite sure. If you ever saw a recent interview he had with a op-ed editor, writer for the New York Times. He asked him about the future of mankind, and he was kind of indifferent about us. You know, we could come, we could go. You know, who knows? It's all kinds of things out there. So, I mean, you know, the problem is that a lot of these billionaires kind of saw the movies that we saw and weren't rooting for the human beings. They were rooting for the AIs.
Very, very strange. A man just gave his Nobel speech when he got the award. It was... for his AI research, and his speech was all about a warning about where AI may take us.
Comment?
Yes, comment away.
So thank you. This is N2IMF. My name is Joe. Just going back to the MRI. When you go to an MRI, and I know this personally because my wife has staples from her gallbladder surgery and screws in her back, you must let them know that you have any kind of screws or metal in you. What they will do then is just use a different type of a MRI, maybe something less powerful, maybe something more localized. But if you have any metal in you, you have to let them know up front, or she could be in a lot of trouble. Back to Ned.
Okay, I think they actually, you know, put a device around you to see what kind of metals they are, if they're at all ferrous, if they're, because, you know, there are different things. There's ferromagnetic, ferrimagnetic, paramagnetic, diamagnetic, antimagnetic. So you got to know what exactly you're using. You know, if you have something that's ferrous, there is no, to my knowledge, no MRI made that's not going to give you a lot of trouble. So, you know, maybe they won't kind of give you the brand new one that's two Teslas instead of one Tesla in magnetic field density. But I think if you tell them that, they do check that out just to make sure. They don't take anyone's word because, you know, what happens if, God forbid, you're wrong about the material that your nuts and screws and staples and such are made from? Rich recognized you doubled with the other gentleman. What does the other gentleman want to say?
Hey there, this is Dean. I'll go after Rich.
Okay, Rich.
I just want to say I have two rods in my back, and I've had many, many, many MRIs, and they only ask me if I have metal on me, not in me, and nothing ever happened.
Okay. Again, they're kind of, you know, it's generally understood that any kind of magnetic material in surgical supplies is a no-no ever since MRIs came about really a long time ago. Back in the 80s, one of the guys who was famous for developing the technology predates MRIs. The technology is actually something that we used as chemists called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. It was back in the 70s and the 80s that Devadanian, I think, was his name. He worked at Downstate Medical Center, where I was taught medicine. Developed the NMRI for human beings, and of course they realized as a marketing person that you never put nuclear any place near a diagnostic test. Human beings don't really like to take anything that says nuclear. So that's why they gave it a quick name change of magnetic resonance imaging and left out the nuclear part. But yeah, ever since those times, people have kind of known. And, you know, titanium is a great alloy. It's not straight titanium as far as I understand. It's an alloy with some other ingredients, but it's all meant to be hypoallergenic and non-reactive and non-magnetic so that it doesn't give you any problem down the road because you don't want to have to remove it and replace it with something else. That's unnecessary trauma. So I'm glad to hear that everything worked out for you there. I don't know what possessed the people working in that diagnostic center. I am sure they are all going to have a whole bunch of lectures about who to let in and who not to let into the facility. But, you know, we'll see how that works out. Was there anyone? Yes, please.
Okay, let's see. First of all, the Bradbury story about stepping on a butterfly and changing history, that was a sound of thunder. A sound of thunder. Yeah, the butterfly effect came from it. About the asbestos, I remember a horror story at Newtown High School back in the late 60s when I was there. in my earth science class, Dr. Soce passed out a rock of asbestos to everybody, and we sat there for about 15 or 20 minutes and had a huge pile of asbestos fluff as we picked at the rock, and this huge pile of asbestos fluff sitting on our desks there that we were all marveling at. And finally she came around and collected it, threw it in the waste paper basket. So we all have a little asbestos in us. The movie was the Darwin Awards, yeah, where he put a J-38 rocket on a car. Very funny movie. About the MRIs, is the magnetic field time-varying where even if it's non-ferrous material, there could be an eddy current problem where eddy currents could be induced into non-ferrous material causing internal heating, or is it just a fixed magnetic field? I assume that the magnetic field does change with time, so maybe there could also be eddy currents induced in non-ferrous but still metal components. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think there's a large degree of variation in the magnetic field. The thing that really runs the MRI is the fluctuating RF energy. It's, you know, you put into a certain steady, very intense magnetic field, then there's a RF generator that sweeps the frequency and the amplitude, and that's what produces the kickback that the sensors detect and then put up on the screen. There is some current that is produced when you move yourself in relation to the magnetic field. So while you're being positioned in and positioned out, there are fluctuations and there are induced currents, and people have very strange sensations in their brain sometimes. But, I mean, when you're kind of locked into the equipment, there shouldn't be that much variation.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I think I remember that the RF field causes precession, I think, of the nucleus of the atom, and that's what they read, that precession, which is generated by the RF and supported by the magnetic field. Okay, thanks, Rick.
You're welcome. Yeah, it induces a precession, and then when you turn the RF, it snaps back, and they read the output from that difference. Anyone with any comments about this particular subject before we move on to the major segment?
Yeah, I got a small contribution.
Sure.
Hey, I work as a surgical PA, putting in spine implants. So I've got some experience with MRIs. Usually they're 1.5 Tesla or 3 Tesla MRIs. Most of the surgical implants going in nowadays are titanium. Ever since around the 80s or the 90s, they switched from stainless steel to titanium. Titanium is non-ferrous, and usually, while it's non-magnetic, it can result in streak artifacts and obscure the imaging on the MRI. But you don't usually have to make any changes to the imaging itself. You just get a little bit of a cloudy picture in the area where those implants are.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, pretty much what I kind of thought was going on there. And it probably, though, is a titanium alloy. I rarely hear anyone these days using just a pure metal. They usually decide that adding something to it, it improves some quality of the alloy.
Affirmative. Sometimes we even use cobalt, especially for the shoes and the spine. In rare cases, we do have some stainless steel implants. Old aneurysms clips in the brain could be stainless steel, and those would prohibit patients from going for MRI. Likewise, patients that have any shrapnel or bullet wounds, usually those contain some steel, and that would prohibit an MRI as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. We don't have a combat mindset these days, so we don't think of people with shrapnel, but they're out there and they do exist. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Anyone else with any comments before we move on? Okay.
About the metal fillings we had years ago, K2GAE.
It depends on what they were made of. If they were made of ferrous material, which is unusual, you have to have them removed. Most my dental fillings when I was a kid were mercury amalgams, which are not magnetic, so you don't have to worry about those.
Just the mercury poison.
Yes, of course. Amalgam tends to be kind of stable. It doesn't really deteriorate, thankfully. A lot of people have been walking around with mercury amalgams for 60 years and haven't developed touches of insanity. So for all intents and purposes, I think I'm okay. I don't think I've gone crazy yet.
Yes.
Well, you never know what the future will bring. Okay, enough of this mirth. Let's go to the main segment here. We're open for comments, questions, topics for discussion. I would prefer for the first few to be amateur radio related, although, as always, I will accept any science or technology related subjects and deal with it as best we can. So if you would please hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's science or amateur radio, and we'll make up a list and we'll try and stick to the order so that no one will feel as though they were pushed away, pushed out. So we're open for business. Hit that push to talk and get your name on the list for tonight.
And to IMF.
EZ AM Radio.
Comment, amateur radio.
Okay, Rich and you were doubled, so I couldn't make out you, so could you repeat yourself, please?
And to IMF. Comment, radio.
Okay, what's your first name, sir?
Joe, Juliet Oscar Echo.
Okay, very good. Rich and Joe are on the list. Who else would be like to be on the list for tonight?
Kilo Charlie 2, Tango November Tango. My name is Ruben.
Is it Ruben? You got a question for tonight?
Yeah. Can I get a signal report on how I sound? Because it has something to do with the antenna on the roof. And I just came out here just to listen, basically, on the TechNet.
Okay, you're free to listen. You're sounding good. You're clear quieting, so you've got captured from the repeater, so you're sounding fine.
Thank you. I've been having antenna issues for a couple of months, and, got to it a couple of days ago, so I wanted to see how I was making it to the repeater. Since I can't hear this repeater, I cannot hear with a portable. Unless I go outside, but in the house, I cannot hear the repeater at all. So that's why I needed my outside antenna with my 7250 ASU. I'm located in Brooklyn, in the Greenwood Heights section of Brooklyn. My name is Ruben. And my call sign is Kilo Charlie 2, Tango November Tango.
Very good, Ruben. I had the same exact problem. As you might remember, I lived very near to Coney Island. And I had, when I tried to get into the repeater, they recognized the noise, and every time someone had a noisy input, they thought it was me. So I had to think hard and eventually put up an antenna on the top of my roof. And even with that antenna on the top of the roof, things have not been great as far as Limark and getting signals out from Brooklyn. So unfortunately, that's the nature of the repeater. I keep on hearing that they're really looking into a repeater for Brooklyn that will be linked to the two major repeaters in Long Island and Queens. And we'll see how that goes.
But your signal's fine, Ruben.
Thank you, thank you. Am I talking to Roy?
Yes, you're talking to the same guy you talked to this morning.
Yes, yes, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. All right there, Roy. Yeah, I know, I know. All right, I'm preheating something in the oven. So I just want to jump in and say hello. I haven't been out here in a number of weeks. So I'm going to be doing some listening. This is KC2TNT, Ruben.
Okay, Ruben. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight? Please hit that push to talk.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Kilo Delta 2, Romeo Echo Kilo. Good evening, everybody supporting.
Okay, Sam's on the list. REK, thank you for supporting. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, we have three people. Hopefully, as time goes on, there'll be a few more added. Rich, what can I do you for?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody else. I have a very basic electronic question. Very basic. What is an LC circuit, and how is it used in radio? That's the question, Roy.
Okay. L is the abbreviation for inductance, and C is the abbreviation for capacitance. So it is an inductor-capacitor circuit. And the question, I guess, is why would you want or need or use a inductor-capacitor circuit? In reality, it's probably more accurate to call it an RLC circuit because any piece of wire will introduce a pure resistance to the equation. So you can't really functionally, unless you have access to a superconducting laboratory, generate a pure RC, pure LC circuit. It's an RLC circuit. But for the sake of simplicity, we'll call it LC. And the reason you do that is because it will allow you to implement filters. You can block frequencies, you can enhance frequencies depending upon the configuration, whether it's a parallel circuit with an inductor in one leg and a capacitor in the other leg, or if it's a serial circuit with a inductor serially connected to a capacitor. And then it depends upon the value of the inductance and the value of the capacitance. They all produce a certain reactance that differs dependent upon the frequency of the current. As you increase the frequency of the current through a capacitor, the capacitive reactance goes down. As you increase the frequency of the current through an inductor, the inductive reactance goes up. And there's a certain point where the capacitive reactance equals the inductive reactance. And they're both ohms, but one's positive ohms and one's negative ohms. They zero each other out. So you will have a point where the effective reactance from the capacitor and the inductor effectively becomes zero, and you have only the minimal resistance of the circuit, and you know that'll at that frequency the current will rush through. At a high frequency, the inductor will block it. At a low frequency, the capacitor will block it. And so that's the means of antenna design, of filter design. All kinds of different filters operate through LC circuits. So if you have any other questions about LC circuits that I haven't answered well for you, please tell me.
Well, both a capacitor and an inductor store and release energy. So how do they work together? Is it like an on-off switch oscillating at whatever frequency the Karners?
No, it's not an on-off frequency. What effectively happens is both for capacitors and inductors will store energy, correct, but they store them different ways. Capacitors will store energy as electrical charge. That's why, you know, when you first short out a capacitor, the plates are charging, and while the plates are charging, you do have a current. As soon as the plates reach maximum saturation of electrical charge, the current stops. So that's why when you first connect a capacitor, the current is high and then goes low. Inductors work the exact opposite way. They store energy as magnetic fields, and their interaction with voltage potential versus current is the exact opposite of capacitors. And so you'll take a sine wave that started out as having the peak current and the peak voltage in the same places, and by putting in an inductor or capacitor, you are shifting the frequency difference between the voltage and the current. And, you know, if the voltage peaks nowhere near where the current peaks, the effect of energy getting through is minimal. But both of these devices will shift that phase degree. When you shift the phase degree back to 0 degrees, you have an intact sine wave with a maximum power being transferred.
And why, you say that it uses filters?
Well, primarily the purpose of these things is to be filters. When you put them together, you can have them separately because they do different things. In the case of power supplies, your power supply coming into your house is 60 cycles. You put it through a transformer to change the voltage to what you want. Then you need to rectify it, depending upon if you use a half bridge or a full bridge rectifier. You now have a direct current that's getting stronger and weaker and stronger and weaker. It has a ripple in it. And if you were to use that power supply for your audio chain, you would notice an annoying 60-cycle hum in the background. So in order to flatten out the ripple, you then use some capacitors in parallel. You know, the bigger the capacitance, the more it will charge and discharge and kind of fill up the empty spaces in the ripple. So that's the case for only a capacitor. Inductors have choke capability and all kinds of fun stuff as well. But when you putting together an LC circuit, it's usually about the resonant frequency of the device's values. The value of the inductor and capacitor and the configuration will determine what the resonant frequency is and whether it will help to get that signal through or just notch it out.
Okay, and how is it used when you apply it to antennas?
Well, as we mentioned last week, most of us are using standing wave antennas, which require a resonant circuit in the form of an antenna. Although we don't really easily perceive it, an antenna is a resonant device. It's the wires and the legs are the inductance, and the edge effect produces the capacitance. So you have both capacitance and you have inductance, and the resonance due to those two values should be the frequency that you're trying to use the antenna with.
Okay, that explains that. So whenever you see a coil on a circuit board, whether it's wound just around air or some kind of ferrite material or whatever, whenever you see a coil, does that mean you have an LC circuit?
Not necessarily. You could just have an RF choke.
So what would be the difference between just an inductor, I guess. Well, let me ask it this way. Whenever you see a coil, you have an inductor. Is that correct?
Yes, the coil is an inductor.
Okay, so if you have a coil without a capacitor, that equals an RF choke?
Yeah, it's a means to block RF energy in the same way that a capacitor will block DC current. If you have RF and DC on a line and you need to feed the RF out, but you want to get rid of the DC because it'll screw up whatever your RF circuit is going to do, you use a capacitor to ground. And so it bleeds off. No, that's you would have a parallel capacitor, and that would block the DC current. If you wanted it the other way, you would have the capacitor go to ground, and that would drain out the RF and leave you only with the DC that wouldn't go through the capacitor, because direct current doesn't go through capacitors, and alternating current is impeded by inductance to a degree. As you increase the inductance, you increase the inductive reactance, and so you block more and more RF current depending upon the strength of the inductor. So it could either be an RF choke, or it could be some way of, in the case of capacitors, a way of blocking the direct current from the signal line.
Okay, so you're saying it could be done in a couple of ways? Cutting off frequencies?
Again, if you want to cut off a certain intermediate number of frequencies, that's what an LC circuit is. You figure out whether you want to have a notch filter or a bandpass. You then calculate the proper inductive reactance, inductance and capacitance, and you wire the tuned circuit. If you just want to make sure that there's no RF on your output, if for some odd reason there's an output line that has DC and RF, and you only want to output the DC, then you simply put a capacitor. You could either put a capacitor in parallel and just kind of bleed the RF, or, you know, something like that. So that will block your RF. So the single component is when you just want either the RF or the DC. The tuned resonant circuit is the LC that you are able to select what frequency you want to either boost or block.
And so are there variable LC circuits?
Yeah, you own a variable capacitor, don't you?
Yeah, but that's a variable capacitor, not a variable LC.
Well, if you vary either the capacitor or the inductance, you have a variable capacitor inductance circuit. But usually it's a capacitor, because it's a bit of a pain in the ass to have variable inductors, although I'm sure many of us do. I have it in my antenna tuner. It's a nice big silver-coated coil with a running shorting bar that is adjustable along the length of the inductor.
Okay. So antenna tuners then are just big LC circuits.
Yes, in the case of antenna tuners, rather than just purely being bandpass filters or notch filters, they are actually impedance matching circuits, because they're a little bit more complicated. There are different forms. There's the T circuit and the L circuit and the pi circuit, but they tend to use a few more discrete components in which they change the effective input versus output impedances.
Okay. Well, I think that does it. I think it's a little clearer. Would you say it is mostly used, an LC circuit is mostly used as some form of filter?
Well, I mean, the mostly is a questionable way of phrasing it. Again, antennas themselves are inherently resonant circuits. And so, you know, I guess you could theoretically think of it as a filter if you want to think of the energy being transferred into the ear as RF. But, you know, I wouldn't kind of be that flippant with the English language. But it's mostly tends to be used outside of antennas and such for different filter purposes.
Okay. Well, I think that that about explains it for me. You know, it's very basic. The term comes up a lot, and I never really understood how the capacitor and the inductor work together. But now I have a better idea, dear Roy. Thanks.
Comment.
WSUN.
Okay, I heard a few people, but I recognize Paul. So, Paul?
Yeah, Roy, wouldn't you consider the basic tank circuit an LC circuit? You know, you have the antenna coming in, going to ground, and in between you have the coil, and then you've got the capacitor in parallel with that. And, of course, most of the time, you have the tuning capacitor. You know, that capacitor becomes the tuning capacitor, and you can change your frequencies. But basically, to me, that's really an LC circuit. You know, your power's going to come through the antenna, the frequency's going to fill up the coil. Well, it's going to fill up the capacitor really first, and then as the cycle changes, you know, for the frequency that's coming in, the capacitor would discharge into the coil, and then the coil or magnetic field would build up. Eventually, as the signal starts to change again, you know, coming into the antenna, the coil forces everything back into the capacitor, back and forth it goes. So I don't know. To me, I would consider that an LC spectrum.
Yeah, it's an impedance transforming device. We mentioned that as the antenna tuner, and yeah, it utilizes inductance and capacitance to change the impedance, the input impedance to a nominal 50 ohms, so that the transmitter is happy with it. So yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of things that ultimately are LC circuits, antennas. You know, you could say that the transmission line is also an LC circuit because coaxial cable operates the wires, the ground shielding, and the center wire is a inductance, and the gap between the two that has the insulating material is a capacitor. So the antenna is an LC circuit, the coax cable is an LC circuit, the antenna tuner is an LC circuit. So, and that brings you back to the transmitter, finally.
KF2ZC.
Comment?
Yeah, do you have any comment to make, though, Paul, before we move on?
No, that was great. Very good. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, Brian?
Good evening. Just checking in. What's the topic du jour tonight?
We were talking with Rich about LC circuits, inductors, and capacitors.
Oh, somebody's creating a matching network?
No, it was more just RF theory.
I see. Well, I hope everyone is doing well. Okay, well, please continue. I'll be here.
Okay, Brian. The other gentleman, I couldn't recognize what they said because Brian was a little louder. So the other person who checked in who had a comment, please comment.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. On my ICOM 7300, there's a button that says Noise Blanker. And I'm listening to a strong station, but there's loud noise, and I hit that button, and it kills everything but the one signal that's really coming in. If I keep the noise blanker on and I tune, I'm not getting all the action that's on the band. Can you explain noise blanker? Maybe it ties into what you're talking about this evening.
It doesn't directly have that much to do with the rest.